vacant spaces beneath the ground that were previously filled by the plant creature. Jason annihilating it entirely with transcendent damage may have left the ground here unstable.
The going definitely wasn't this rough during the trials, Humphrey said. It was definitely easier to find a path through.
When we were looking for a way to get past the plant monster, Jason said, Jory told me that the plants in this astral space have adapted to feed on the heavy magic saturation. Maybe the plant monster was soaking most of that up, and now it's gone. It could be that the remaining plant life has been gorging, leading to the explosion in growth.
I'm more concerned about the monsters, Sophie said.
What monsters? Neil asked. We haven't seen one since we entered this thick patch of jungle.
Exactly, Sophie said. The only other time we've gone this long without a monster coming at us is when we've stopped for the night.
It has been a while, Humphrey agreed. I would have expected at least some kind of snake monster by now, in terrain like this.
Maybe we're just lucky, Neil said.
Or maybe the local monsters know something we don't, Sophie said.
Most of the team were city folk. Jason had grown up in a small beach town, while Neil, Belinda, and Sophie were all from Greenstone. Humphrey had mostly grown up in the Delta, but the carefully landscaped Geller estate was hardly the open wilds. While they had all spent time adventuring in the Delta, it was the academic Clive who turned out to be the most comfortable in the terrain. He had grown up in the proper Delta, on his family eel farm. He was the surest of foot and the most observant of their surroundings. Clive was also the most educated about the potential threats, with a knowledge of monsters second only to the Magic Society records he had spent so much time cataloguing. This allowed him to spot something that the others overlooked, and he stopped to examine it.
What did you find? Humphrey asked, as Clive peered intently at some white residue on a large green leaf.
Clive looked around, spotting more of it.
Not sure, Clive said. Some kind of secretion, probably from a monster. This is old, so it's hard to be sure. If you look close, there are some lingering traces of magic.
Most of the team had magical senses, so they joined Clive in peering at the residue.
I can barely sense it, Neil said. You have no idea what this could be?
I have hundreds of ideas of what this could be, Clive said. I need more information to shave them down before I'd be comfortable making any kind of guess.
The team continued onward, still not encountering any monsters, but occasionally spotting more of the residue. They found some that was fresher, dangling from a tree branch like string. The residual magic on it was stronger, and Jason rubbed the substance between his thumb and forefinger.
"Should you be touching that?" Belinda asked. I'm pretty sure the first rule of dealing with mysterious magical stuff is not to touch it.
I thought I felt something in the magic, Jason said.
Blood magic.
And that made you want to touch it? Neil asked.
I'm definitely getting a feel of blood magic off of this, Jason said.
Not essence magic like mine, though, some kind of monster power.
Humphrey spotted Clive's frown.
What is it? Humphrey asked him.
It's still early to speculate, Clive said.
Something just popped into your head, Humphrey said. We trust your instincts.
Clive gave another reluctant frown.
This residue, he said. Does it look like old spiderweb to anyone else?
Could be, Humphrey said.
This residual magic had lasted long enough that we're likely looking at something silver rank, Clive said. If we combine that with blood magic and webs, then something does come to mind, something I would rather be wrong about.
Which is? Neil asked.
Have any of you heard of a blood weaver?
Humphrey let out a low breath, while the others shook their heads.
What's a blood weaver? Jason asked.
A spider monster, as you might surmise from the webs. It's silver rank, and more intelligent than most lower rank monsters. It's still more animal cunning than real intellect, but it's very much capable of planning and long-term thinking.
That's not what it's famous for, though, Humphrey said.
After it feeds on a normal animal or monster, it can turn them into a deathless servant. Zombies. But there is something worse.
Why is it always something worse? Neil asked. Why can't it ever be something better? Like cake.
Oh, I could go a nice fluffy sponge cake, Jason said.
Did you bring one? Neil asked hopefully.
Yes, but you can't have it until you rank up.
Do try and keep on topic, boys,
Belinda chided.
Sorry, Neil and Jason said together.
As I was saying, Humphrey said, a blood weaver can turn regular people and animals into undead, shambling husks. Nothing too dangerous. A monster or essence user, though, it can turn into a vampire. A blood puppet, to go out and collect more victims for the blood weaver to consume.
So you're saying these cultists might be vampires now? Neil said.
It's only a possibility, Clive said. Given the environment, current magical density, and the blood magic in the webs, though, it all fits.
Can we even fight the cultists if they're vampires on top of everything else? Neil asked.
Actually, they would be easier to fight, Clive said. Individually, anyway. They have vampiric powers, but they can no longer access their essence abilities. They still have those abilities, because the soul is still in there, but they can't use them without the body they no longer control. The body will still be affected by passive powers, but the controlled body can't use any active abilities, because it can't control the soul, which is essentially trapped.
I know what that feels like, Jason said, darkly.
What's about the tracking stones?
Belinda asked.
If the cultists were turned into undead, would their stones still show them as alive?
I'm not sure, Clive said. It's possible, since they do still have their souls. Or I could be wrong about all of this. There's no blood weavers and the cultists are off playing cards somewhere.
Can you think of something worse it could be rather than a blood weaver? Neil asked.
Not off the top of my head, Clive said.
Then that's probably what we're dealing with, Neil said. It always turns out to be the worst possible option.
I can think of something worse, Jason said.
The team all looked at him.
They could have called it a vampire.
The team continued on, the white residue becoming more and more evident. It quickly became clear that it was definitively remnant webs, and they found a clearing where the trees were draped with webbing-like curtains. There were old web sacks, the size of people and larger, that had been burst open from the inside. There was dried blood caked inside them that still reeked.
An old nest, Clive said. It's definitely a blood weaver.
Chapter 40. Brave Little Taylor. Clive stood up from where he had been crouching to examine one of the empty web sacks. The clearing was only the beginning, with empty web sacks hanging from trees or fallen to the ground, extending well back into the jungle. Clive had gone over them all, carefully examining the interior of each one.
"Unless there are some other people here that we weren't aware of," Clive said. "I would say that all of our cultists were snatched up by the blood weaver. The web sacks pack their victim in, nice and snug, and there are 13 of these things that look like human molds inside. Looks like she either ate the 5 that died completely and turned the rest, or the process has a failure rate."
"So now we know for certain that we have to hunt this thing," Sophie said. "How do we find it?"
"We don't," Clive said. "We've all seen what a silver rank monster can do. I doubt we could take the monster down if we caught it by itself, let alone with what I hope is only a small army of vampiric monsters. The weaver's minions are something of a hive mind, controlled by the monster itself. Once we start fighting any of them, we're fighting all of them. We can't beat them all, and the blood weaver on top."
"We don't know how long we have to stop whatever the cult is up to," Belinda said. "As much as I like the backing off idea, don't we have to go after it now if it will take us to the cultists?"
"At this point, I don't know how much the cultists have to offer us," Clive said. "I doubt we'll ever find them in a state where we can question them. Maybe if we kill the Blood Weaver first, they'll regain some sense of self and be able to talk to us. More likely, though, we'll have to try and find some clue from their corpses.
The cultists were a dangerous enough proposition when they were just a bundle of cut-rate adventurers, Neil said. Now they have a silver-ranked monster behind them? We've all seen what a silver-ranked monster can do.
Exactly, Humphrey said.
We can't stop anything if we're the blood puppets of some giant spider.
Clive, where do we have to get to before we can take that thing down? At the very least, Jason has to hit bronze rank, Clive said. The Blood Weaver is silver rank tough, heals fast, and can heal even faster by feeding on its own minions. Jason's escalating damage is our only means of getting through that, even once we hit bronze.
Can't he do that now? Sophie asked. He has an ability to get past higher rank resistances, right?
That is a silver rank monster, Clive said, and not some lumbering giant he can outpace. At iron rank, he's too slow, too weak, and too frail. He'll die before he can lock those afflictions in. And that is just considering the monster itself. The rest of us need to hold off the vampiric monster army long enough for Jason to get the job done. Given the magical density, we have to assume there will be a ready supply of bronze rank monsters for that, and the cultists certainly will be. Maybe there'll only be as many of them as there are web sacks around here, but from the state of this webbing, I think this is an older nest. I'm willing to bet that there's more. That's a bet we're gambling our lives with.
So you're saying we need to run for the hills? Jason said.
We have the best training environment any of us will ever experience, Clive said. Every adventurer rises up during a monster surge, and we have one that never ends all to ourselves. We have to use it. I say we stop chasing the trail of cultists and focus solely on getting as strong as we can, as quick as we can.
I completely agree, Humphrey said. I know that stopping the cult was hammered into us as the first priority once we got here, but now that path leads somewhere that we aren't ready to go yet. I propose we walk right back out of here and start following the soul compass to abomination after abomination, taking on anything that gets in our path. That isn't also silver rank, Neil amended.
That isn't also silver rank, Humphrey agreed.
We stick to the training regimen, maximize our advancement. I'll reach bronze before Jason, and Neil probably will as well. That's our threshold to return. Sophie and Belinda will take longer than the rest of us, which is time we may not have. We don't know that we have enough as it is. Humphrey gave Belinda and Sophie a sympathetic look.
It means that when we go after the Blood Weaver, you'll be the most vulnerable.
Speak for yourself, Sophie said. I'll hold my own.
I'm pretty sure he meant me, Belinda said. I'll stick with Clive and Neil. Boosting bronze rankers will give me the chance to carry my own weight.
Wait, Neil said. Did we just make the sensible decision and not charge into the hopeless fight? Go team! After trying to portal past the jungle, the team had also tried portals to other locations and had confirmed that portal abilities wouldn't work at all. This forced them to extract from the thick ring of jungle by tracking back the way they had come. It quickly became evident that their presence had already been noticed.
There are monsters approaching from multiple sides,
Shade warned from Jason's shadow as his other two bodies scouted the jungle around them.
Judging from their physical appearance, disparate nature, and cohesive movement, I believe them to be the Blood Weaver's vampiric puppets.
The team had developed their teamwork enough that they had no need to discuss tactics as they moved into a defensive formation. In the tight confines of the dense jungle, Humphrey and Sophie stood guard over Neil, Belinda, and Clive as Jason vanished into the darkness. Onslow emerged and Clive vaulted lightly onto his back. Even at the very start of bronze rank, Clive's power and speed attributes gave him the strength of a huge powerlifter and the agility of a tiny gymnast. Belinda also called on her familiars, the silver lantern floating above her, and the living illusion, a flickering replica of herself, that shimmered into existence at her side.
Why only move on us now? Neil wondered.
They were waiting for us to go deeper into the Blood Weaver's territory, Clive said. Now we're trying to leave.
We didn't sense them at all.
Many spider-type monsters can use networks of webbing to track their prey over a wide territory, Humphrey said.
Clive didn't mention that before,
Neil said.
Clive didn't know, Clive said testily. Maybe if adventurers were less dismissive about sharing information with the Magic Society, then there'd be fewer gaps in our knowledge.
Focus, Humphrey said. Jason should be starting right about... An alien shriek echoed through the jungle. They sensed the approaching auras before they saw the monsters. It was a disparate group, bronze and iron ranks mixed together, but the same thread ran through each of the different auras. It felt like a blood-soaked wire leash held in the grip of an unseen master.
I definitely don't want that in my aura, Sophie said.
Monsters came pouring out of the jungle, varieties they had encountered before in the city, but changed. Eyes were bloodshot, skin was pale and taut over ropey muscle. There were snakes with barbs lining their backs, two-headed cats and colourful, spike-spitting frogs. Almost half their number were the ape-like creatures Clive had fought, but even more feral. There was a crazed hunger about the attackers as they rushed at the team. Humphrey and Sophie leapt into action. Sophie was a veritable blur, deflecting flying spikes and crippling ape monsters one after the other. It was almost like they were standing still as fists and feet, elbows, knees, and palm strikes were rained down on joints, throats, and eyes. Despite the onslaught, her face was calm, her movements as clinical and precise as they were fast. She fought with the clean efficiency of a machine, with no waste, no hesitation, and no mercy. A two-headed cat leapt high over the other monsters, sailing through the air towards her. She threw out a hand and a blast of wind sent it hurtling back into the jungle.
Ability: wind wave, wind. Special ability: movement. Cost: moderate mana. Cooldown: 6 seconds. Current rank: iron, 6, 41%. Effect: iron. Produce a powerful blast of air that can push away enemies and physical projectiles. Can be used to launch into the air or move rapidly while already airborne.
A barbed snake jumped at her from a low angle, and she snatched it out of the air, one hand on each of its upper and lower jaws. She reefed her hands apart, and the snake's head with it, not even pausing as she continued to square off with the ape creatures. One of the bronze-rank apes emerged, faster and stronger than the others. It barreled through its fellows as it charged at Sophie. She activated an ability, and time slowed to a stop around her.
Ability: Eternal Moment, Swift. Special ability: Cost, Extreme Mana per Second and Stamina per Second. Cooldown: None. Current rank: Iron, 5, 91%. Effect: Iron. Operate at a highly accelerated speed for 1 second of actual time, which is extended in subjective time.
Sophie's massive acceleration power only gave her a fleeting moment of near-frozen time to act. She waved her arms rapidly back and forth in front of her, each sweep producing an arced blade of wind that froze the moment it was separated from her body.
Ability: Wind Blade, Wind. Special attack: Cost, low mana. Cooldown: None. Current rank: Iron, 8, 88%. Effect: Iron. Create a cutting projectile of air.
The frozen time ended after the briefest interval, but Sophie's quick movements had primed a wall of wind blades. The instant the power ended, they were all unleashed on the monster charging at her, shredding the hulking ape into a bloody mess. Its charge became a stagger, and she kicked it square in the chest, bloodying her boot. It fell over backwards and didn't move again. Although she was incredibly quick on her feet, Sophie was holding her ground, not moving far as she fended off attackers. Humphrey, in the meantime, was the sword to her shield, charging forward to take the fight to the enemy. He conjured up his enormous sword, stylized in the form of a dragon's wing, that was immediately wreathed in flames.
Ability: Dragon Wing Sword, Wing. Conjuration: Fire. Cost: High Mana. Cooldown: 1 minute. Current rank: Bronze, 0.00%. Effect: Iron. Conjures a huge sword in the shape of a dragon's wing. Special attacks with the movement subtype performed with this weapon inflict additional damage. Effect: Bronze. Normal and special attacks made with this weapon inflict fire damage and inflict the burning condition. Burning: Affliction. Damage over time: Elemental. Inflicts ongoing fire damage.
The fire damage hardly seemed relevant as the sword brushed away enemies like fallen leaves.
Ability: Unstoppable Force, Might.
Special attack. Cost, high mana, extreme stamina. Cooldown, 1 minute. Current rank, bronze, 0.00%. Effect, iron. Melee attack with massive momentum, dealing large amounts of additional resonating force and disruptive force damage. Requires a heavy weapon. Effect, bronze. For each enemy struck, the cooldown of this ability and the cost of the next use of this ability are reduced. Three of the ape monsters and a two-headed cat all but exploded, their bodies not even slowing the horizontal sweep of the enormous sword. Humphrey paid no mind to self-protection as he arrived amidst the monsters like a lobbed grenade. He was well protected, however, starting with the dragon scale armor he conjured directly onto his body. Ability, dragon armor, dragon. Conjuration, cost, high mana, cooldown, none. Current rank, bronze, 0.00%. Effect, iron, conjures a suit of dragon scale armor that confers strong physical protection and increases resistance to fire damage and effects. Effect, bronze, armor confers increased resistance to non-physical damage and further increased resistance to fire damage and effects. As Humphrey laid into the enemy, an illusory image fought beside him, harmless but distracting, making his attacks hard to anticipate. Just when the monsters thought they had the real Humphrey pegged, they would learn they were fighting his illusionary double. This was Belinda's familiar, Gemini, who could not only mimic allies but switch teleport with them. It used a mental connection with the mimicked ally to do so, like a more instinctual version of Jason's voice chat. It was an oddly intimate connection that allowed the ally to trigger the power. The power of Belinda's familiar was quite similar to one of Humphrey's own. Ability, attack of the Mirage Dragon. Transfigured from human, ability, special attack affinity. You are more likely to awaken special attacks than other ability types. Your special attacks have increased effect. When you make special attacks, you can expend mana to create a short-lived illusory double, replicating the attack. The illusion does not inflict damage or duplicate other effects from the attack, but you can spend mana to switch teleport with it in the moment it is created. This is an illusion and teleport effect. With every special attack, he not only created another short-lived double, but Gemini did the same, leaving four of Humphrey running around for the monsters to try and pin down. Only Humphrey's allies were able to see the hazy blur that signaled which ones were illusions. Dashing into the swarm of attackers had opened him up to their attacks, and some inevitably went for Humphrey's true body. Many of those attacks were intercepted by well-timed but short-lived bubble shields, courtesy of Neil. Ability, absorbing shield, shield. Special ability, recovery, retribution, drain. Cost, high mana, cooldown, 20 seconds. Current rank, bronze, 0.00%. Effect, iron. Create a short-lived shield that negates an incoming attack and generates mana over time, with a strength that scales with the amount of damage negated. High damage attacks of silver rank or higher may not be entirely negated. Effect, bronze. Drains health and mana from the attacker and bestows it upon the recipient of the shield. Neil's absorbing shield simultaneously protected Humphrey and replenished his health and mana, allowing him to keep fighting at full strength. In addition to the drain effect, one of Neil's evolved racial gifts was incredibly valuable. Ability, lifeguard, transfigured from elf, ability, life affinity. Effects used or received with a positive effect on life have greater effect. Using a shield-based essence ability on allies also bestows a heal over time effect. If too many enemies were crowding on Humphrey, Neil would deploy his other bubble shield power. Ability, burst shield, shield. Special ability, recovery, retribution. Cost, moderate mana. Cooldown, 20 seconds. Current rank, bronze, 0.00%. Effect, iron. Create a short-lived shield that negates an incoming attack and explodes out, knocking back nearby enemies and inflicting concussive damage. High damage attacks of silver rank or higher may not be entirely negated. Effect, bronze, inflicts Vibrant Echo on anyone damaged by the blast. Vibrant Echo, affliction, damage over time, magic, inflicts ongoing resonating force damage. While Humphrey and Sophie were both fighting multiple monsters, just the pair of them was not enough to cover every angle of approach.
Monsters that tried to snake into the gaps were met by elemental attacks from Onslow and bolts of force from Belinda's lantern familiar, Shimmer. Belinda used her spurious sorcerer ability, granting her the power to use a wand from which she blasted bolts of fire. Clive's weapons were still stowed in his storage space as he sat atop Onslow, chanting out an extremely lengthy spell. When he was done, a huge red and gold eye appeared in the sky like a celestial body. It had the look of a fiery nebula, resembling an angry version of the eye in the torso of Jason's familiar, Gordon. Ability: Eye of Karma, Karmic. Spell: Zone, Retribution. Cost: Extreme Mana. Cooldown: 24 hours. Current rank: Bronze, 0.04%. Effect: Iron. Creates a wide area zone. Within the zone, all damage inflicted by enemies or by effects generated by enemies cause disruptive force damage to be inflicted on the enemy that was the source of the damage. Effect: Bronze. Whenever damage triggers the zone effect, the damaged ally gains an instance of good karma, and the enemy gains an instance of bad karma. Good karma: boon, holy, stacking. Damage from enemies with bad karma is reduced. This does not reduce the retributive damage suffered by enemies with bad karma. Additional instances have a cumulative effect. Bad karma: affliction, holy, retribution, stacking. A portion of damage you deal to enemies with good karma is also suffered by you as transcendent damage. Additional instances have a cumulative effect to a maximum of 100% damage return. The team spent mana like water, knowing that mana recovery was one of their greatest strengths. Clive, Neil, and Sophie all had powers that would replenish the mana of teammates within their overlapping auras, while Clive and Neil also had spells to replenish team mana. After completing the zone spell, Clive pulled out his weapons and started blasting away. They were not as effective, without the time to set up ritual enhancement, but were still potent weapons. He also replenished Onslow's powers. The monsters attacking Humphrey and Sophie were now harming themselves as a result of the zone spell, but the sheer number of enemies still threatened to overrun the team. From Clive's quick count, there were at least 30 here, not counting however many Jason was off fighting in the jungle. Despite the team's efforts, there were still too many, and they were about to be overwhelmed. Belinda started chanting her own long spell, and just as it seemed like the team would be steamrolled, the battlefield shifted. Ability: Unexpected Allies, Charlatan. Spell: Illusion, Dimension, Teleport. Cost: Extreme Mana. Cooldown: 1 hour. Current rank: Iron, 4, 16%. Effect: Iron. You and your allies take on illusionary forms of nearby enemies, but your allies can still recognize one another. All allies and enemies in the area are randomly switch teleported. Just as the team's formation was about to be broken up under the press of opponents, Belinda's spell detonated it. The team was randomly teleported, as were the monsters. The teleport was short and relatively gentle, barely phasing those members of the team sensitive to it. The monsters, however, were thrown into confusion by their sudden displacement and the seeming disappearance of their enemies. Unable to see through the illusionary shrouds now covering the team, the creatures milled about in confusion. Belinda's power was the keystone of one of the team's tactics for engaging larger groups, which Jason dubbed the Brave Little Taylor strategy. They made judicious attacks that prompted the monsters to attack one another, their discord briefly disrupting the thread of control in their aura. On top of the monsters harming one another, Clive's zone spell inflicted even more damage. The controlling force quickly reasserted itself, but the sudden chaos had given the team time to gather together. Jason had notified them that all the surviving monsters had gathered close, and he emerged from the shadows. It was just in time to vanish with the team as Neil used an ability. Ability: Reaper's Redoubt, Shield. Special ability: Dimension, Disease. Cost: Extreme Mana. Cooldown: 6 hours. Current rank: Iron, 8, 64%. Effect: Iron. Take allies into a dimensional space briefly while flooding the area with death energy, dealing disruptive force damage, necrotic damage, and inflicting creeping death on everything in the area. Creeping death: damage over time, disease, stacking,
Inflicts ongoing necrotic damage until the disease is cleansed. Additional instances have a cumulative effect. When the team re-emerged from the dimensional space a few short moments later, the landscape had been transformed into a horrifying Tartarus. The death energy of Neil's Reaper power had riven the jungle around them, leaving dead and rotting monsters amongst blackened and withered jungle. The overgrowth was black mulch underfoot, while the wood of the trees had rotted and split, sending them tumbling to the ground. A few bronze rank monsters had survived, but they were hurt and no longer had numbers on their side. The team made short work of them.
"Was anyone bitten in all of that?" Clive asked. "Vampire bites can have some unpleasant effects."
"Their teeth only found my armor," Humphrey said.
"I took a few claws and a spike or two, but no bites,"
Sophie said. Jason used his affliction-absorbing power on Sophie, cleansing the poison of the spit of frog spines.
"My blood powers were quite effective," Jason said. "Turns out vampires are a bit susceptible to blood magic."
"We can have the post-fight discussion later," Humphrey said. "For now, we put as much distance between us and that spider as we can."
Chapter 41. Terms of the Pact.
"Those vampiric monsters were a bit disappointing," Jason said. "They didn't seem so much vampiric as hungover. A bit peaky, bloodshot eyes. They didn't even summon any bats."
"They're spider vampires," Neil said. "Why would they summon bats?"
"Well, they didn't summon any spiders either."
"I don't think that's how it works," Belinda said. "Didn't the spider kind of summon them?"
"That's a good point," Jason said.
The team had extricated themselves from the ring of dense jungle, returning to relatively intact streets and buildings of the overgrown city. They made sure they were well clear before putting up the cloud house and stopping for the night.
"Everyone take a good rest," Humphrey said. "From here on out, our sole focus is on getting stronger."
"It's a shame there's no movie essence," Jason mused to himself. "A training montage power would be OP."
"What nonsense are you talking now?" Sophie asked.
"I think I know this," Clive said. "There's a fable from your world about learning to fight by cleaning an old man's carriage, right?"
"There are different renditions of the story," Jason said. "A lot of it comes down to your tolerance for power ballads. The message, though, is that everything we do is kung fu. That's a term that, where I come from, has come to mean martial arts. What it really means, though, is accomplishment through diligent effort. Every action we take and every word we say is something that shapes us. The diligent person acts to improve and empower themselves with everything they do, no matter how mundane."
"Then why do you run around like a mad person, talking nonsense, instead of being all diligent?" Neil asked.
"Because everything is a weapon," Jason said. "And there are few weapons as powerful as the way people look at you." Jason's expression went through a subtle, yet powerful change. The cocky smile was suddenly sinister, his laughing eyes becoming predatory as they locked down on Neil. Under that gaze, Neil shifted uncomfortably in his seat, unnerved as Jason watched him like a hawk eyeing a mouse. Then Jason flashed a grin, eyes twinkling as he dissolved the tension as suddenly as he brought it about.
"Everything is a weapon," Jason repeated, "if you know how to use it. There's no better weapon you can give your enemy than being predictable. Every one of you has, at some point, told someone to not bother trying to understand what I'm talking about. If an enemy doesn't even try and understand me, that's a weapon and shield they've just handed to me for free."
"What about your allies?" Neil asked. "Don't they need to rely on you?"
"They do need to, yes."
"Do you trust me, Humphrey?"
"Yes."
"Clive?"
"Yeah."
"Sophie?"
"Yes."
Jason smiled at Neil.
"What about you, Neil? Do you trust me to stand at your back? That I'll be there when you need me to be?"
"I guess I do," Neil admitted.
"You grew up in a world of magical power,"
Jason said, turning his gaze from Neil to address the whole team. Direct, objective, honest power. I came from a political world where power is nebulous and the wars are as much about ideology as territory. We grow up watching leaders who need to sway the populace in order to hold power, even as the populace can share information in ways that would be as amazing to you as magic is to me. Jason nodded at Humphrey. Humphrey's mother encouraged our friendship because she recognized that I had a more political mind than is normally to be found in Greenstone. I'm sure it's different in more cosmopolitan cities, but the politics here are amateurish and crude. Dangerous, yes, because power always is, but not especially complicated. She wanted Humphrey to get to know me so he would see the next guy like me coming. Jason conjured his dagger into his hand. This, he said, is the weakest weapon there is. A blade can cut down a person, but words can bring down a kingdom. Adultery can end a dynasty, greed can start a war, and compassion can end one. People will die for strangers out of faith and kill their neighbours out of fear. He casually tossed aside the dagger, and it vanished. Everything is a weapon, he concluded. The trick is learning to wield them without doing yourself an injury. The room fell quiet in the wake of Jason's impromptu speech, until Sophie broke the silence.
Sweet gods, you like to hear yourself talk.
The team fell into a regimented schedule of physical training, skill training, mental training, and monster hunting. Days became weeks, and Humphrey joined Clive at bronze rank, his square-jawed handsomeness becoming even more pronounced. As Clive had already reached bronze rank, he was relegated to lowest priority during training. This afforded him the time to study the changes to the astral space's ambient magic. He was trying to learn what was causing the changes and how it was preventing them from using portals or escaping. He didn't find the answers he was looking for, but he did make other discoveries, which he laid out one evening in the Cloud House.
"The magical density is increasing," he announced to the team. "I'm not exactly sure why, but something seems to be forcing a highly dense magic into this astral space."
"What does that mean for us?" Humphrey asked.
"A few things," Clive said. "One, we aren't getting out of here until we find whatever is causing this and stop it. Two, we need to keep up this training because the monsters are going to be getting stronger. We'll see fewer iron ranks over time, and running into a silver will become more and more of an inevitability. Three, the rate at which this astral space will break down is on an increasingly steep curve. We're still talking a matter of years, for the moment, but as the magical density goes up, the time frame will come down."
"Well, that's only completely terrifying," Neil said.
"What do you recommend we do?" Humphrey asked.
"We already have the right plan," Clive said. "Improving our strength is more important than ever, and the cultists are still our best chance at getting a handle on what's happening. We need to deal with that blood weaver and hopefully figure out what they were up to."
"All right," Humphrey said.
"Jason, Sophie, and Belinda will be pushing all the focus onto you. Once Jason reaches bronze, we'll move immediately on the blood weaver. Sophie and Belinda will get you to bronze as quickly as we can. We can't have you still at iron rank if we're going to be meeting silver rank monsters with any regularity." Belinda's abilities were progressing at a steady, but not exceptional, pace. She had reached the point where she could comfortably fight small groups of iron rank monsters alone, using the abilities that gave her temporary skills. They found that she actually advanced more quickly from group fights, where more of her powers could be used effectively. Belinda's jack-of-all-trades power set lacked the punch to jump ranks and fight a bronze rank monster alone. Sophie had no such problems, relishing both the fights and the resulting rapid advancement of her abilities. The monster-infested city was eager to oblige. They saw as many fights in a day as an active adventure in Greenstone would in a week. Ranking up the latter stages of an ability was a harder, slower progress, but iron rank monsters were getting harder to come by. They were replaced with more bronze rankers, who offered enough challenge to keep their advancement proceeding at their original pace.
The monsters appeared in the kind of numbers the team had originally encountered the Iron Rank ones, and the team was more and more required to fight as a whole instead of peeling off members to maximize the challenge. Jason had expected his familiar ability for Shade to be the hardest to rank up. Colin and Gordon were both able to engage directly in combat, whereas Shade's power to attack amounted to little more than some mana draining. To Jason's surprise, Shade kept pace with Gordon, rapidly passing through the lower levels of advancement. While not an attacker, Shade's utility as a shadow jump target saw Jason heavily rely on him in combat. In hindsight, Jason realized that of course a utility-type familiar would advance from utility tasks. To help that along, he practiced sharing the senses of one of Shade's remote bodies. It would be useful in allowing him to directly observe from safety whatever his familiar was scouting out. He could even speak through Shade, although his voice chat was still a superior communication method. The cult hidden at the Vane Estate had a visitor, Anissa LaSalle. Timos led her through the grounds, now dead and dry as the desert reclaimed them. The hedge maze was now a dry twig maze, and the cult had a more direct path to the center, through which Timos led the priestess. She had arrived alone, while Timos had a pair of iron rank lackeys on hand. "It's been a while, priestess," Timos said, a smile playing on his lips. "How was your sabbatical?" Walking beside him, Anissa LaSalle glanced at Timos with disdain. The elven priestess was wearing extremely fitted adventuring gear, its monochromatic white barely paler than her skin. Her platinum hair was bound back in a simple and practical ponytail. "I detest you and your kind," she said. "Frankly, I would rather have stayed in hiding than deal with you. Each indignity I have suffered over the past months can be laid solely at the feet of your failures."
"Your memory is poor, priestess," Timos said. "I think you'll find that the impatience of your god has..."
Timos was cut off as Anissa's gloved hand clutched his throat, her thumb pressing savagely into his windpipe. His two lackeys moved to assist, but a trio of searing orbs of light appeared to hover threateningly in front of them.
"You will not disparage my god," Anissa told Timos calmly. "In fact, it would be best for all involved if you never profaned his name with your tainted lips. Am I making myself clear?"
Timos nodded, choking all the more at the action. She released him, and he fell to his knees, coughing and spluttering. His eyes shot venom up at her as he rubbed his throat, but he nodded again.
"I understand," he said. "See that you do. Now stand up. I'm not going to stand idle waiting for you to recover from the latest in a long series of errors."
Timos's people looked ready to act, but he stilled them with a head shake. The gesture was not unnoticed by Anissa, but she did not deign to comment. He staggered to his feet and they continued on, reaching what had once been the well at the center of the maze. No one had checked on the estate since the rejectors' party had passed through, and the cult had decided excavating the well and the crawl tunnel at the bottom was an acceptable risk. One of the cultists with earth-shaping powers had created a set of stone stairs into what originally had been a natural cavern. The wooden walkway, once traversed by Jason, had been removed and the walls and floor smoothed out. Stone walls had been put up to form a subterranean complex. They had no woodworker, so despite ample materials above, curtains hung in place of doors. Glowstones affixed to the walls lit the rooms and hallways. Timos led the priestess through the complex, but she stopped halfway. Her eyes were boring into one of the cultists, a grizzled man moving a crate of supplies.
"You," she said to the man. "I know you."
"Yes, miss. I'm Dougal. I let you out of the cage when the blood cult had you captured."
"A rat jumping ship," she said.
You caught wind of Remor putting paid to your little branch of the Red Table and realized you would need a new master. The Blood Cult deals with failure in very carnivorous ways, after all. Clearly, you knew much more of Landemir Vane's loyalties than anyone in the household realized. The opportunistic loyalty of a cultist is revealed as base and self-serving in the face of adversity. Where does your faith lie?
I don't want you to speak.
Or perhaps you should. I remember that you were looking for a taste of elf flesh. Are you still looking to feast on my bones, cultist?
I would never miss.
Pathetic. You aren't worth the blood stain to kill.
She swept off, Timos hurrying to keep showing the way. They went all the way to the metal door leading into Landemir Vane's old ritual room. Everything had been stripped away to the bare stone. The only features remaining were an archway in the centre of the room, the complex ritual circle around it, and the mana lamps that artificially heightened the ambient magic, allowing the circle to function. The cult was charging a large number of lamps around the estate to keep the ritual circle operational. The archway looked like it had been made from salvaged building materials, an irregular construction of cheap-looking, mismatched bricks held in place with what looked like ordinary mortar. The silver-rank leader of the cultists, Zato, stood with his back to the door, looking at an inert archway. He turned at their entry, eyes lingering on the marks on Timos's neck, but saying nothing.
How long?
Anissa demanded, without preamble.
Weeks, Zato said.
2.5 months, at the outside.
2.5 months, Anissa raged. You have already had more than enough time.
And your church has nowhere near enough patience, Zato yelled back.
Every problem you blame us for goes back to your church refusing to wait, the way you were counseled. Your insistence on acting so early cost us everything and gained us nothing. It's like you somehow think you worship the god of time, able to make things happen whenever you want. If your church had been willing to wait, then the cult's identity and your trafficking with us would both remain secret. We are still years away from the true beginning, but you had to act like impatient children.
Anissa fumed, but she was bronze to his silver rank and had her orders.
I am here to inform you that your request is unacceptable, she said, biting off every word. We will not be acceding to it.
You go and tell your archbishop that not only will his people be joining us in the astral space, but so will he. The laxity of your church cost us every silver ranker we had in this region. I'm the only exception, and I had barely ranked up when your people led the Remors to the island. I hadn't even been fully inducted into the leadership.
The blame for what occurred on the island does not fall on us.
Of course it doesn't, Zato sneered.
Every success is yours, and every failure is mine. I might as well argue with a child. We lost a gold ranker in the island attack, so do not come complaining to me, Anissa said.
I did not call you here to hear complaints, Zato said, regaining his composure.
I am invoking the terms of the pact. Nicholas Hendren will be leading his people to join us when the tunnel finishes forming and the portal opens. I expect all of you here in 2 months.
Anissa gave him a smile that somehow perfectly encapsulated hatred, but said nothing. She turned on the spot and swept out of the room like an angry wind.
Chapter 42. Trading safety today for death tomorrow. The team had been aware going in that there were locations within the city that were more than just empty ruins. A number of trial goers had reported such locations to the Magic Society and Emir's people, who had undertaken a large-scale debrief of the Iron Rankers who survived the trials.
In addition to being full of monsters, unlike those found elsewhere in the city, such locations held unusually valuable treasures. Clive had been one of those who encountered such a place during the trials, where he obtained the legendary set of items both he and Neil now wielded. For him, it was a staff and wand set that had become a crucial part of his combat potential. For Neil, it was a fist-sized orb that shone with a blue light when held, and a gold circlet with a blue gem set into the forehead. The abilities combined to powerfully enhance his shielding powers, which the team appreciated. Given the formidable power of the abilities on those items, the team eagerly explored any location that was outside of the ordinary. In addition to being as likely as any other place to have monsters to confront, there was always the chance of treasure. With the battles to come, any advantage was a much-needed blessing. Most such places were either subterranean complexes or atop unusually tall buildings, as Clive's had been. The first of these locations the team encountered was a sprawling complex of underground forges, foundries, and furnaces. In addition to having dangerous fire and iron elementals, it was infested with bizarre undead, with metal fused into their bodies like magical cyborgs. Jason had found it a frustrating place to fight. Most of the enemies were highly resistant, if not outright immune, to his abilities. He made good use of the sword Gary had given him, but it was a marked step down in his capabilities.
"It's good for you," Sophie had told him.
"If you only train for when things go right, you die the moment they go wrong," Humphrey said. "Yeah," Jason acknowledged unhappily. "Rufus used to tell me almost the exact same thing." That place had eventually yielded some impressive treasures, although not so useful as those Clive had found. There was a pair of gloves that enhanced fire and iron-based abilities, and an anvil that enhanced the crafting of weapons. The team took them with the intention of delivering them to Gary. The complex had also delivered a solid haul of essences and awakening stones, almost all fire and iron. They were both common, but very popular, meaning they would fetch a good price once they returned to civilization. They were a welcome addition to the piles of spirit coins and quintessence gems piling up in their storage spaces, courtesy of Jason and Neil's looting powers. The next similar location they came across was likewise underground. They were uncertain to its nature at first, as it was very plain, but they could tell it was unusual from how intact it was. Most subterranean spaces in the city were thick with mold and root systems breaking in through the walls and ceiling. This complex was all square tunnels and empty rooms, the brickwork uniform and unblemished.
"There doesn't seem to be anything here," Belinda said, as they looked over another empty room. "No loot, no monsters nesting in here, not even the dilapidated furniture and such you get in most of the ruins."
"All these empty rooms remind me of the place we found in the delta under the swamp," Humphrey said.
"That's worth remembering," Clive said. "That place seemed empty until we had a face full of marsh hydra."
"A good lesson," Humphrey agreed. "This place may well be empty because the one thing in here has scared off the rest." "Are we ready to face a silver rank monster?" Neil asked. "We haven't had to do it yet, but the monsters have been getting stronger and stronger. We hardly see any iron ranks anymore."
"If we caught one in isolation, then maybe," Humphrey said. "The problem is that we still have too many iron rankers."
"I'm so close to bronze, I can taste it," Neil said. They continued through the complex, finally discovering what it was. "A prison," Jason said, as he surveyed the latest room they had entered. "That's great. Nothing bad ever happened in a creepy, abandoned subterranean prison. I'm so glad monsters turned out to be real." They were in a large, long cell block, with a mezzanine level running along each side. The cells running the length of the room on both levels were barred, giving the team a clear look inside. None of the cells had occupants, each as empty as every other room they had come across. Moving through the large cell block, they found stairs that led down into another and then a third. It was there that they finally found something.
"Signs of combat," Clive said. "This really does remind me of that place we found."
"This is fresher," Humphrey said, examining a scorch mark on the wall. "Most likely someone found this place during the trials." "There's something at the far end of the room," Jason said. His ability to see through darkness extended beyond where the light of the team's glowstones grew dim.
The team moved forward carefully, finding a handful of corpses scattered about where they had fallen. A violent demise and months in the muggy underground chamber had not left them in a pleasant state, but as Jason's powers left enemies in much the same condition, they were used to it. Rather than dwell on the state of the bodies, they considered what might have left them that way. "No trace of whatever killed them," Jason said. "It seems the fight was either one-sided, or whoever killed them took their own fallen when they left." "Hard to determine what killed them from the bodies," Neil said. "They're too far gone to make out much. I am seeing some broken bones, so something physically powerful, maybe."
"We didn't fight anything on the way in here," Sophie said, already eyeing the room around them. "There weren't any signs of combat before this, and I think they would have left some. I'm seeing scorch marks, chunks torn out of the stone floor. I think that whatever killed them didn't show up until they reached this point."
None of the team had dropped their guard, but for the moment, nothing was making an attack. "It could have been other adventurers," Jason said. "We know that at least some of us were killing each other."
"All we can do is be cautious moving forward," Humphrey said. "That and collect these poor souls for return to their families."
They went about the grisly task of retrieving Adventure Society badges for identification and to return to the families. There had been discussion of retrieving remains before they came in, but storage space was at a premium for coffins and any remains were likely to be a mess. A number of families made quiet approaches to try and make specific arrangements for their lost people, but Humphrey flatly refused. He insisted on keeping things even-handed and restricting recovery to Adventure Society badges.
"What about their equipment?" Belinda asked. "It feels ghoulish to loot the dead."
"We'll return their gear to the families, along with the remains," Humphrey said, "once they're identified."
At the end of the cell block, not far past the bodies, was a pair of large doors. They were metal, but unlike the bars of the cells, were unblemished by time and moisture. They were plain and heavy, with a large keyhole on each. There were traces of a ritual circle drawn around each keyhole.
"Maybe that's what brought out whatever killed them," Jason said. "Trying to break in triggered some kind of defences, maybe?"
"The obvious solution, then, would be to not break in," Neil said. "I mean, treasure is nice, but we just picked up a dead adventuring team. Do we really want to be the next one?"
"He's not wrong," Jason said. "We have a responsibility here. We may be the only ones who can stop the cult from tearing this astral space off the side of the world. Or whatever it is they're going to do with those giant golems. We can't go getting ourselves killed over some loot."
"On the other hand," Humphrey said, "we need to push ourselves to the limit and beyond. We don't know what kind of challenges we'll have to face in stopping the cult, but I don't think the cultists being captured by the Blood Weaver is the end of it. I'm certain there are greater challenges ahead before we can put paid to the cult's intentions."
"So you're saying we should face whatever killed these people as a training exercise?" Jason asked.
"Since when are you the voice of moderation?" Clive asked.
"I'm not saying we shouldn't do it," Jason said. "I just think that the idea of not doing it is worth exploring. I've been too reckless too often. I've survived too many times on luck, which sooner or later is going to run out. This isn't a monster we have some idea about before we go in. We backed off because we weren't ready for the Blood Weaver. What if this is worse?"
"We need to get you and Neil over the threshold for bronze," Humphrey said.
"I'm not sure this will do it," Jason said. "If there is a still active defense system here, then it has to be something that didn't die out in all the years this place has been dormant. My guess would be some kind of construct guardian or maybe some undead. I won't get to work out my powers like that."
"Your familiars are the last abilities you have to advance," Humphrey said. "If your other abilities are less useful, your familiars become more important."
"I say we go for it," Sophie said. "Humphrey's right that we need to have experience of having something dropped on us that we aren't ready for. Better we experience that now, so we have the experience before the cultists do it to us."
"What do you think, Clive?" Humphrey asked.
Clive rubbed his chin thoughtfully.
"The biggest danger is to our iron rankers," he said. "I think we leave the decision to them."
"That's fair," Humphrey said. "So, what's it going to be?"
"I'm still up for it."
"If Sophie's in, I'm in," Belinda said.
"I'm going to say no,"
Jason said. If Neil wants to make it 3-1, I'm fine with that, but if he wants to play it safe, I'll back him. Everyone turned to Neil. Great, Neil said. Now it's my fault if everyone dies. You're saying go for it? Jason asked.
Jason, you weren't there during the expedition, Neil said. You haven't fought these people. You haven't seen the monstrosities they turn themselves into. The endless sea of constructs at their command. I don't know what they're going to bring to bear against us, but we can't be ready enough. Not taking every chance we have to get stronger is trading safety today for death tomorrow.
And here I was thinking that you were the sensible one, Jason said. All right, then. Of course, if we're wrong about the defense mechanisms, this whole conversation was pointless. The decision made, Clive turned his attention to the large doors.
They messed up their unlocking ritual, Clive said. Even at a glance, I can see how amateurish it was. No wonder they set off any defenses.
Then do what they did, Jason said. You can worry about getting it right afterwards.
That's not very professional, Clive complained.
Being professional isn't the objective right now, Jason said.
If the goal isn't to get it right, then you might as well do it, Clive said.
That's hurtful, Jason said. But fair enough. Everyone else get ready. While the team gathered in preparation for a fight, Jason examined the doors and the remnant lines of a ritual circle drawn onto each in chalk. You weren't kidding, Clive, Jason said. Even I can tell this is a dog's breakfast. It looks like someone who barely knew what they were doing just copied this ritual out of a book.
Probably someone who used a ritual magic skill book and never took the time to learn any theory, Clive said.
Was that aimed at me? Jason asked. I've been hitting the books pretty hard, as you well know.
Can you please just get on with it? Humphrey asked.
Sorry, Jason said. Jason took out a stick of chalk to redraw in the faded lines. He recognized the basic unlocking ritual, which was indeed something that had been in the ritual magic skill book he had used himself. That, fortunately, meant that he had the ritual incantation memorized, which was somewhat tricky. The chant was made up of a series of sounds that were, in and of themselves, meaningless rather than coherent words. They simply existed to set up a resonance and begin channeling magic through the ritualist and into the ritual diagram. Jason carried out the ritual, but the locks in the middle of the ritual circles glowed red hot. Much of the redrawn circles burst off the doors in a puff of chalk dust. Jason turned and joined the others, drawing his sword in readiness for whatever appeared to meet them. They did not have to wait long. Individual bricks in the walls and floor drew back into recesses with a grinding of stone. Moments later, small stone and metal spiders came swarming out of the holes all over the room. They immediately scuttled towards the group, swarming over the walls and across the ceiling. The construct creatures had minimal auras, but they were clearly iron rank.
Belinda, Neil? Humphrey said.
Yeah, Belinda said.
Got it, Neil followed. On your call, Belinda?
The tiny constructs had painted the walls and ceiling as they moved on the team. As the front runners edged closer and closer, some of the team threw Belinda glances.
Belinda? Neil asked.
Wait, she said calmly.
Construct spiders dropped off the ceiling and the upper parts of the walls as they drew excruciatingly close to the team. Clive raised his staff to fire off a blast and Belinda waved him down with a gesture.
Not yet, she said.
Are you kidding?
Clive asked.
I have to catch a lot of them, Belinda said. All right, Neil. Now.
Neil chanted out a quick spell.
Let your power fulminate.
Ability, bolster, growth, spell, boon. Cost, low mana. Cooldown, none. Current rank, bronze, 0.00%. Effect, iron. The next essence ability used by the target ally has increased effect. This can affect parameters including damage, range, and number of targets, depending on the affected ability. Cannot be used on self. Effect, bronze. Mana and stamina costs of the affected ability are reduced. In the case of ongoing mana and stamina costs, only costs initiated with the ability are affected. Costs invoked subsequent to the ability being activated are unaffected. As soon as she felt the power of Neil's spell affecting her, Belinda threw out her hand and a crystal rod rose up from the floor.
Ability, force tether, trap, conjuration, cost, low mana per second, cooldown, no.